morning, 68, Kenosha and Racine, 61 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
I'm excited to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Dr. Jonathan Fader, who is one of the most highly regarded sports psychologists and works with an array of major league teams, particularly in Major League Baseball, although he has worked with elite athletes in an array of different sports and done superb work with them, and has now written a really interesting book called Life as Sport: What Top Athletes Can Teach You About How to Win in Life. It essentially is a book in which he draws from his rich experience as a sports psychologist at the most elite level and draws some important life lessons that can apply to the rest of us who are not professional athletes or maybe scarcely athletes at all, but lessons which might be helpful for the rest of us in whatever arenas we find ourselves personally and professionally. The book is published by Da Capo Press, and I'm really honored to be able to speak with Dr. Jonathan Fader about his book, Life as Sport. Dr. Fader, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, Greg, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I really liked how you introduced me because I think you really got it. You know, people are wondering, what can sports psychology bring me in my day-to-day life? And there's so many applications to just, you know, really living life as a sport, being at your best and enjoying it more, that elite athletes do, but that we can do in every aspect of our work and home life.
Right. How did you happen to find yourself in this particular field? Were you always interested in psychology and then just sort of fell into this particular niche? Or do you come to this as someone who was an athlete yourself and you bring that experience to the table? I mean, how is it that this has become the focus of your professional energies?
Great question. Well, as far as my athletic ability, I mean, I could probably hit the garbage can from about 4 feet away with a crumpled up piece of paper, but that's as far as it went. I think, you know, I always say that I didn't choose sport and performance psychology. It chose me in the sense that I really was lucky enough to be put in position to be exposed to it. I mean, early on in my career in graduate school at the University of Washington, where I did my doctorate, there was really one of the luminary figures in sports psychology, Ron Smith, who did so much research and work with different baseball teams like the Astros and others. So, you know, he really set it up and worked, you know, for different organizations and showed me this could be done. But really what appealed to me about it, Greg, is that so much of psychology is focused on what's wrong. How do we fix this problem? You know, what's got people down? And sport and performance psychology is a strength-based technique that says, well, how do we give people the techniques to get better? How do we focus on the solution, not the problem? How do we view things as a challenge and not a threat? And so that has always appealed to me as a philosophy, so I was really drawn to that and continue to be so.
Hmm. One thing that we should probably get out of the way, because I think as people listen to this interview, it might strike them as maybe a little bit odd, is the fact that we're not going to make a specific reference to the Major League Baseball team with which you are primarily affiliated. And we should mention that you've actually worked with a number of different Major League ball clubs. There is one in particular with which you've worked very, very closely, both in their minor league program and Major League program. But we're not going to mention that team, nor are we going to mention any of the specific individual athletes with which you continue to have a working relationship. It maybe goes without saying that it is important to have some discretion, but maybe say a word further about why this is something that's very, very important to you when you have these conversations about your book, Life as Sport.
Well, that's really a good question, Greg. I mean, in my book, You know, as you said, I work with elite athletes in many different sports, and I work with teams in different sports, and I always do my best to protect the confidentiality of those relationships. So in my book, I talk a lot specifically about some athletes who've said to me, hey, listen, you can talk about, you know, me. Most of those people are people that I haven't worked with, and that I've talked about, you know, they're colleagues of mine in different sports, Laird Hamilton, the elite surfer, Dave Winfield, the Hall of Fame baseball player. They're in the book, and they talk in detail about, you know, their interest in the field of sports psychology and how they've developed over the years a way of being excellent. I really put other people in the book that I've worked with in different sports, and I do that in an anonymous way to protect them because, you know, this work is work that is sometimes very private work. And it's but, you know, what we're really trying to do is make it less private as time goes on and really normalize it because, you know, this work is different from, you know, as I said, a secret problem that people have or something what they want to keep private. We're working to really bring it out to the light, and this book is a step in that direction to say sports psychology, also known sort of sometimes as mental conditioning. I always say curls for your brain. Hmm. You do curls for your biceps, you do squats for your legs. Well, what are you doing for your mental conditioning? What are you doing to keep yourself sharp, relaxed, ready for the moment? Hmm. And so that's really what we do in sport performance psychology. We're trying to keep people, you know, attached to the current moment and to use the skills that science shows to do that.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons that, you know, I'm really careful about not talking about people I'm working with unless they say, hey, go ahead and do it. But I'm also working to try to change the perception of what, you know, sport and performance psychology is. It's not only about fixing a problem. I always say that, you know, if you're waiting to fix the problem, you might have gotten to the scene too late, right?
That's probably too late, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really about preparing people for adversity. Certainly, if people face adversity, you want to get to them and help them. But a lot of what we do is try to prepare people for greatness and to face adversity and to enjoy things all along the way.
Right, so and maybe a little less adversity will confront them if they've kind
absolutely.
Of laid more positive groundwork. I wonder about your work as well, that I think for some of us on the outside, very much on the outside looking in, we wonder how much of what you do is, in a sense, team-oriented, about standing in front of a group of athletes. I mean, standing in front of the team and giving presentations and leading discussions on some of these principles versus sitting down one-on-one with a particular athlete, you know, maybe particularly one that might be especially vulnerable or fragile or facing some adversity. I mean, do you do both, or is it primarily one or the other?
Well, it depends on the sport. I mean, with some individual athletes, they're a solo athlete, right? So if I'm, you know, working with, for example, a cyclist, or and there are team obviously aspects to cycling, or if I'm working with a marathon runner, or if I'm working with a surfer, that in itself is a one person. And by the way, we're all individual athletes in some way, right? So, you know, you have a radio show, you're a solo athlete, but you have a team. You have, you know, people that work with you in technology and producing and all this. But you know, I also work with teams. So let's say I'm working with a soccer team or a hockey team, and I'm going in to talk to them about something. A lot of those are about, you know, how the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, that there's a certain energy in a team that is comprised of the way in which they work together. And specifically, what that usually amounts to are two things. Do people understand kind of what their role in the team is, and do they accept and like their role in the team? And if those are really worked out in the group and individually, usually the team, you know, is performing superiorly. And also, does the team have a common goal? You know, if a hockey team or a softball team, if a bunch of people are working together for a common mission or goal, they're all focused on and drilled down on the same, you know, underlying core principle of togetherness, and they can articulate what that is in a few words. A brotherhood or a sisterhood, for example? Are they really a band of brothers? And is that cultivated in a group environment? Those teams usually succeed and deal with adversity and injury and all kinds of things like that to a higher degree.
Hmm. One thing I wanted to be sure to ask you about as well, and again, we're steering clear of any specific mention of the specific team with which you have been especially affiliated, but in the extensive work that you have done with Major League Baseball and with one team in particular, I know that you began your work with them in some kind of rookie career development program, and then the minor league athletes and then eventually to the major league team. In a sense, you've kind of worked your way up the ranks the same way a typical aspiring baseball player does. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about what the difference has been for you in this work as a sports psychologist. That is, working with young, hungry athletes desperate to ascend from the minor leagues into the majors, versus working with major league baseball players who are already there and anxious to stay there. Is there a profound difference in the work that you do, or in the challenges that you confront as a sports psychologist in those two different realms of the world of professional baseball?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the interesting thing about your question is that the corollary to the rest of life is, you know, in baseball, in elite sports, I work with, you know, different groups of people. And the ones you're pointing out are people that have made it, right? They've succeeded. They're there. They're in the show. They're in the big leagues. They're in the NBA. They're in the NHL. They're there. Or they're people that are fighting their way up through the vast swath funnel of people that are trying to get there. And there are certain things and obstacles that face you. So if you're listening to the show and you're someone who's just starting out in various aspects of sport, various aspects of business, there are certain things that are more important to focus on than when you get there, when you have a lot on the line. And I think the main thing that I've realized over time is that when people achieve success, there's often an emptiness around it if they don't find their enjoyment. That when you're really coming up through the ranks, really you're just focusing on kind of getting there. All your direction is to getting there. But, you know, I'm reading this other great book, you know, which is The Obstacle is the Way. And one of the quotes in there is, you know, from a Haitian, I think, quote that says, behind mountains, there are more mountains. So oftentimes when we're going up through the minor leagues of any experience, we assume that when we get there, we're going to be satisfied. It's often not the case. So what my book also about is, you know, whether you've gotten to the Hall of Fame in any situation, financial, teaching, parenting, you know, there's always a next challenge. And how you prepare yourself to enjoy that process, I think, dictates how satisfied you are. I'm all about helping people attain greatness, and that's what my field is about. But one of the ways that I've taken this work and what I write about in Life of Sport is, what is the practice of enjoyment? Not only succeeding and getting there to the big leagues of any sport or life, but also enjoying the process, enjoying the moment, and seeing that as a practicable skill.
We're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Fader, a leading sports psychologist and the author of a book called Life as Sport, What Top Athletes Can Teach You About How to Win in Life. The book is an attempt to draw some parallels between what certain professional elite athletes experience, how they contend with their own professional challenges as elite athletes, and some of those lessons and principles which perhaps can be applicable to the rest of us in whatever fields of endeavor we're engaged in our own relatively humdrum lives. And it's really a well-written book. Dr. Fader, I wonder, as you've talked about this book, I wonder if you've met with much in the way of resistance from people who maybe are not easily or at least initially excited about the idea of using kind of the framework of competitive sports to think about their own lives. I mean, with winning and losing and succeeding and failing and so on. Is this, in a sense, a tough sell for some people who really don't want their lives to be sort of thought of in that way?
Well, I mean, Greg, you're getting to the core of this book, which is, you know, this book is definitely about learning how to be at your best. But the real battle to win is with yourself. And everybody's going to set up their own metrics, their own regard for what that is. But, you know, the person I'm battling, it's not even a battle, I would call it more of a dance, is, you know, to really be connected to what my true calling is and what satisfies me and gives me purpose and value in life. For me personally, that's a combination of getting the message out there that there is more enjoyment and more satisfaction that can be gleaned from life if you practice it, bringing this technique to the world. But it's also involved in being a parent and being a husband and all the other aspects that give me meaning. And so every day I'm trying to do that dance with a little bit more, you know, salsa swing and a little bit more connectedness. And I have a passion for that. So the sports idea is really just a metaphor. So for those of you that are out there that don't consider yourself a sports fan even, or that are thinking about it as, well, I'm not an elite athlete. You are. We're all elite athletes in our own lives. We're all, you know, out there playing the game every day. And by game, I don't mean it's unimportant. It is the most important thing we have. It's the opportunity to go out there and to find our connection with life and with ourselves. And so it's not about winning in the traditional sense that you're going to put up, you know, the buzzer-beating shot, to put up that three-pointer and, you know, swish in this successful moment in your life. It's about saying when you go home and you get under those covers and you're tired, do you feel like you really lived? Do you feel like you really connected with each moment? Do you feel like your radio show, your day at the bank, your day with your kids was one in which when they're sportscasting and they're looking back at Monday, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking it and looking at what you did or didn't do, do you feel like you really did it? And if you didn't, what are the things that you can do to create more connectedness to the moment, to, you know, really create much more of a being in the moment in the way you want to be and bringing the best of yourself? If you ask me, that's winning.
Right. So you talk about four pillars upon which this book and for that matter, your work is built in terms of what is really necessary for an elite athlete to enjoy success and in a sense being successful and enjoying that success and the way in which they kind of run together. And in fact, one of those four pillars, in fact, is enjoyment. And you spend a lot of time in the book talking about something which in a sense might seem like it goes without saying. Well, of course, you're a Major League Baseball player. Who wouldn't enjoy that? But of course, it's very, very possible to lose sight of that heart of enjoyment, which is why you picked up a baseball bat or whatever in the first place. In fact, one of my favorite quotes in the entire book is from the legendary golfer Jack Nicklaus, who says something to the effect that nobody succeeds in anything they don't enjoy. Yeah, here it is, right at the top of chapter one. I am a firm believer that people only do their best at things they truly enjoy. It's difficult to excel at something you don't enjoy. Perhaps it goes without saying, but it's an important thing to say. What is your advice in terms of finding that kernel of enjoyment in whatever it is that we do?
Well, I'll start from the very doable, the most specific advice I can give. And then I'll work at my way out and go back to the deeper levels of the question you asked. Greg, look, what I recommend to people is every day, at the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, you develop a routine where you just ask yourself, what did I enjoy most about today? What was I most grateful for? That's it. I do it for myself. I do that with my kids. And I'm a firm believer. And there's some science to support that kind of gratitude and enjoyment, it can contribute to anything from physical to emotional to performance benefits. So if you're really just listening to this and you just want to do one thing to increase enjoyment in your life, just see what happens if for the next month. I give you a 30-day challenge. I'm going to give it to you, Greg. Greg, I challenge you, man. So, Greg, in the next 30 days, just, you know, maybe you already do it. You seem like a guy who might. But every day, just go home and say, what did I enjoy most about my show today? What was the moment where I felt like, wow, that was really me at my best, or me feeling good about my connection with someone I'm interviewing? And then what am I most grateful for? What's the thing that, you know, gives me the sense of appreciation of being alive today? So that's a very specific thing you could do to change your routine to create more enjoyment in your life. Very easy to do. You're taking, you know, less time than you would to pick up something that you dropped. You know, really a very minor change that could create huge benefits in your life satisfaction.
It sounds like this is an example of one of the enjoyment exercises, which we find sprinkled throughout the book. I mean, very tangible ways to kind of tap into this. The other pillars include something so important, present and future orientation. The fact that most of us spend too much time sort of hooked on something that's already occurred and ruminating on it, dwelling on it in a counterproductive way. you really call for us to be much more oriented to the present moment and to some extent to the future.
No question. And you know, in my experience, I think the present moment is the most important. Although I found that when I talk about things like mindfulness and focusing on the present and the techniques we use in the book to do that, many people, not just athletes, but many parents, many people who are teachers, many people who are in law enforcement really want to also focus on what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, I think that's fine. I just try to separate that into two aspects. One is called goal setting, which is the whole chapter on, which is how do you focus on setting correct and helpful goals for yourself, ones that are based on the process and not on the outcome, which we talk a lot about in the book. And so that's why I have a future focus. But really, you know, a lot of what we do is help people to be connected to the moment. If you talk to elite athletes or performers, whether they're on the stage or the musicians, et cetera, what you find is that in the moments that they're actually at their best, they really tell you that things kind of slow down. They talk about, you know, the ball looking bigger, that they feel in the zone. And, you know, that flow experience, as we call it, where your ability meets your challenge, really can be, you can prepare yourself for that. And so we talk about the connection to the present moment, that those moments, you're really not usually doing any technique. You've just learned a way of being. And that the power of that, to learn to be in that moment, whether you're a parent, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a sports psychologist, whether you have an excellent radio show, you know, that power to connect to the present moment and really be there and with your full presence has been shown, in my experience and in many elite performers' experience, to have great power in producing the results we want.
And towards that end, one of your pillars is also that we not focus too much on results, but rather on the process. And, of course, if we do that, the results tend to take care of themselves. And you also talk in really nuanced terms about optimism and call for us to demonstrate what you like to call objective optimism, rather than just a sunny, oh, I'm sure this will all work out kind of optimism, which doesn't do anybody any good.
No question. I mean, I always joke with people that, you know, they developed that, you know, they found this new neurological center. It's called the BS meter. In other words, your brain has this way of saying, if you just feed it this kind of, you know, positivity stuff, your brain's like, no, that's not true. I'm not going to believe any of it. And, you know, our brains are built to notice what's wrong. We have a very sophisticated nervous system, and it's there to notice, hey, is something wrong? When we were cave people, and you know, we were programmed to look for the saber-toothed tiger. Like, what's wrong here? How am I going to get eaten? We're programmed to be somewhat negative, to have a negativity bias, right? Because it doesn't matter if we notice the sunshine day and the rabbits jumping around. If we miss the tiger, we're going to be doomed. And so we have to fight that urge a lot in performance, in our lives, to say, let me notice what's right here. Let me notice what I've done right. Let me notice what's going right. And to be really fact-based about it. As you said, it's not that helpful to say, I'm going to really do great, because that may not be the case. But it is helpful to say, you know what? I've been trained well for this. You know what? I've done well in these aspects of this before. And, you know, if I don't do great, what's really the worst thing that can happen? Those kind of thinking patterns can be really helpful as programming yourself, messaging yourself, self-statement, self-talk, that can create a better vibe, a better moment for you to be your best.
The book again is called Life as Sport, What Top Athletes Can Teach You About How to Win in Life. The book is published by Dacapo Press and the author, Dr. Jonathan Fader. Dr. Fader, I have really enjoyed your book and really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I enjoyed talking with you and hope to talk to you again.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 coming up in just a moment. We spend this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about a very interesting memoir. In fact, the subtitle of this memoir says, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. And boy, that is a really apt way to describe the story of Francis Slakey and the story told in his memoir, To the Last Breath. Professor Francis Slakey decided for sort of an interesting mix of reasons to undertake a very rare, maybe unprecedented gauntlet, to climb the highest mountain on every continent on Earth and to surf every ocean on Earth. And along the way, in ways that he could not possibly have anticipated, Francis Slakey ended up sort of discovering a lot about himself and in a sense, opening himself up to new experiences, especially on sort of an emotional level that he had never anticipated before. Growing from a state which he at one point in the book describes as cold and broken. It's really an amazing story, and a story full of surprises and also some really death-defying drama as well. And I'm very excited that I can speak with Francis Slakey, or should I say Professor Francis Slakey, Upjohn Lecturer on Physics and Public Policy at Georgetown University. And he writes a great deal on the relationship between science and society at large, co-founder of the program on Science in the Public Interest. And maybe you have heard him on NPR or seen his work in National Geographic, Washington Post, The New York Times, and other places. This book, again, is titled To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes, published by Simon & Schuster. Francis Slakey, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Pleasure to be on.
This is quite an interesting story, and I would also say that it's a very, in a sense, sort of asymmetrical story, or maybe I don't want to sound uncomplimentary, but it's kind of an untidy story compared to some books. I mean, in the
sense... it makes me wonder how many people's lives are actually tidy to begin with. I think when you set out to write a memoir, either you try to clean it up and gloss it up and make it pretty, or you just tell things as they happen. And in my case, I just told it all.
Absolutely.
I told it all as it happened. Yeah.
It's one of the things that makes this book so really very, very interesting and unexpectedly so, in the sense that we might glance at the cover and glance at the title and figure that this is going to be another book about climbing a lot of mountains. And there are a lot of books out there like that. But in many respects, what ends up being far more dramatic for you than climbing Mount Everest is the experience of sort of self-discovery and self-transformation that occurs to you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it began, some of that transformation began at Everest. The whole journey took 12 years, and there were moments in the journey where just completely unexpected things happen. You know, I tell you, Greg, when you set out into the world, you discover there are things that happen out there that are way beyond your control. And when I began the journey, I think I just thought I could control all my circumstances and discovered pretty quickly into it that that things were just way beyond what I could control myself. And those things eventually just influenced me to the point where I became a different person.
Before we actually talk about your story, I wonder if you could just say a word about what you understood at the time versus what became clearer as you sat down and wrote this book. I think I talked to a lot of authors in which the act of sitting down and putting a story down on paper provides all kinds of clarification. I wonder if that was really the case with you. It sounds in many ways like much of the clarification really did happen through the course of this journey. And then the book is...
It's an interesting combination, Greg. So it did happen through the course of the journey. And just to make it clear to your listeners just how much change there was in my life, you know, 15 years ago, I had what I called my pillars. I mean, they were the foundations of my life. And it was, I would never get married. I would never have kids. I would never buy a house because any one of those things would create attachments. And I just didn't want any attachments. And here I am more than a decade later, married. I have twin girls in a home that I own. So all of those pillars just tumbled away, and they tumbled away one after another over the course of the journey when I realized that I had just been thinking way too narrowly about myself and about the world.
In describing yourself before this transformation took place, you at one point evoke the words cold and broken.
I do. You know, it's something that people attributed to me, and I don't think I fully grasped it at the time, but I had started out my journey by going to Africa and climbing Kilimanjaro. It was a routine climb. Nothing unexpected happened on the climb itself. It was, as I found so many times during the journey, it was the circumstances that surrounded the event, the climb or the surfing, that influenced me. And in the case of Kilimanjaro, it was when I confronted some Maasais in the savanna that surrounds Kilimanjaro, and I met with one of the elders of the tribe. And we had, you know, an exchange, and I sort of stepped into things. I ended up writing a story about it. When that story was published, readers reacted sharply to it and suggested that I was cold and broken. And that, I think, I hadn't really confronted that until I read the readers' responses at that point.
And, of course, this whole journey around the world and all these adventures end up being kind of a gauntlet of self-examination and coming to better understand this truth, uncomfortable truth about yourself. Let's turn back earlier, though, into the story for a moment, because one of the most interesting moments in the story, in the book, is when you take us back to when you were 11 years old and your mother died from cancer.
Yeah.
And describe this moment to our listeners and describe what you believe to be its sort of lasting consequences.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those moments, Greg, you had asked a few minutes ago, were there things that came to me in the act of writing the book? And I think this is one thing I really came to grips with when I wrote the book. And this was when my mother died when I was young. But shortly before she died, we were passing each other in the hallway. She had declined, her health had declined to the point where she could no longer walk. And my father was carrying her down the hallway. And there she was in his arms, and it was a narrow hallway, and my father had to turn, and so we passed each other. My mother and I barely touched each other. She didn't say any words, but I felt something at the time. I mean, I heard her voice. I still hear it today. And she said, "Be strong." And I think at the time, I misunderstood what she was trying to convey with that, and thought that I interpreted it more as defiance and, you know, get out there in the world and conquer it and take it on. And it was only much later in my life, in fact, at the end of my journey, when I realized that those words had a much different intention.
I think that really makes a lot of sense, that I think a lot of people can act in that way and believe it on some level to be exactly the right thing to do, to put up sort of a stoic front, to try to kind of thicken one's skin, if that's possible, and sort of weather the blow rather than really feeling it deeply. And do you feel like that sort of marked you for a long time afterwards? I mean, is that what sort of set you on this path for such a long time of in a sense living coldly and disconnected from others?
Yes, I think so. I think that certainly contributed to it. Shortly after that, I was in Utah, and a friend and I were climbing, and he decided he wanted to try to climb down a mountain. I was uneasy about it. I told him I would meet him at the bottom. I would take a bus ride down the mountain, and he could climb down on his own. And he fell in his attempt to down climb, and and died from that. And, you know, so it was, I think those two things back to back, Greg, really just iced me up and made me the detached person I was for so many years.
I really think you put it well in describing going back to actually to your mother's deterioration and eventually her death from cancer. You said that I reacted by thickening my defenses. I decided that I would never again let something cut into me so deeply. And, of course, little could you have imagined that the journey out of that state of being would involve mountain climbing and surfing and so on. I mean, I think the unlikelihood of that and the fact that all of this surprised you is probably a big reason why it happened. I mean, why it ended up being, in a sense, the most effective sort of cure for that kind of
thing. Yeah, well said. I mean, I think when it helped me step out, and it made me realize, particularly when I had a confrontation in the jungles of Indonesia, I would say that was one of the real turning points in my life. And let me just say a few words about it for your listeners. But there's a mountain in Irian Jaya that's surrounded by jungle, and rather than trying to hack through all the jungle, my climbing partner and I decided that we would cut through a mine that butts up right next to the mountain. And in order to do that, we decided we would bribe the Indonesian military that guards the mine. I have to make that confession to your readers that that I did commit that felony offense of bribing a military officer, but in any case, that officer took the money, drove us up the mine, we did our climb, we drove back down, and as we were coming back down the mine, soldiers stepped out in front of the Jeep. They started yelling at us, and our driver started yelling back. I didn't understand what was being said. I yelled at the driver, what's going on? And then suddenly this voice cut through everything, and I did understand it because it was in English, and the soldier said, get out of the Jeep. And we got out of the Jeep. We were surrounded by the soldiers. I figured we only had a few moments to come up with some solution, and we just opened up our wallets. We just gave them more money, and they backed away, and we drove on. But then a few days later, I discovered when I picked up an international newspaper that someone else was in a Jeep driving down the very same road, was surrounded by soldiers at that very same spot. But in their case, the soldiers pulled the triggers. And two people were gunned down dead, seven more critically injured. And just a few months later, I would be sitting across the table from one of the women, Patsy Spear, who survived that ambush. She had been rushed to a hospital. She had 100 pieces of shrapnel in her internal organs. Her internal organs actually had to be taken out, put into a tray in front of her, and tweezed to take out the shrapnel. And she survived that. And when I sat across the table from her and talked through that ambush and realized I was talking to somebody who had taken the bullet instead of me, I had dodged a bullet and met the person who took that bullet instead of me. And I tell you, Greg, that just changed my life. Mm. It really brought me out of my shell.
Mm. In the experience that you actually had, I mean, of being in such dire danger in that jungle in Indonesia, one of the things you describe that is just sort of searing in its intensity is you say this situation was totally outside my control. There was no rope that I could decide to pull or not pull. Instead, there were only triggers, and it was up to the soldiers, not me, to decide whether to pull them or not. This was not the kind of dramatic moment that I seek. This was utter helplessness. I mean, I think all of us can well understand how frightening a situation like this would be. But in a sense, for you, it was even more than frightening. It was also, for you, probably the most vulnerable and powerless you had ever felt in your whole life.
Yeah, that's true. And I, it's at so many stages in my life, decisions that I've made, I felt like I had control of the circumstances, and it was up to me to determine what path I would follow. And when I confronted that situation, it was truly just, and it was outside of my control, and there was this helpless feeling that I had. And then, you know, compounding that just days later to find out that someone else was in the same situation and had the disastrous outcome of you know, bullets being shot at him. And the combination of me experiencing the helplessness and then discovering, actually meeting the person who had to survive that ambush, it's a very powerful experience. Mm.
We're speaking with Francis Slakey about his book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. That's really probably the most dramatic, but by no means not the only moment in which your life was in danger and you were taxed beyond your sort of immediate abilities and resources. I mean, really brushing up against danger, that happened again and again. You say early in the book, the journey, this ultimate journey that you take all around the world, would completely unravel me and then bind me back together into someone who could feel and care. I wonder if you could say a word about the process of being unraveled. And if we are talking about, for instance, that those experiences of complete vulnerability that you just described happening in the jungles of Indonesia at gunpoint, or if we are talking about other factors beyond that, and maybe some fairly subtle that also contributed to this process of unraveling.
Certainly it was Indonesia and the helplessness I felt at that moment. There were other moments along the way. Let me describe one to your listeners. It was on Everest, and I think I summited it solo, so I was alone. It was there was a blizzard. It was just whiteout conditions, and then in my descent, I discovered a couple other climbers who had gotten into just horrible circumstances. And what I witnessed was just the heroism and the selflessness of my climbing partner, Jim Williams, and his, you know, lucid decisions and his willingness to put his own life at risk to save another. And that seeing the heroism of someone, just being in that circumstance, confronted with the same decisions that he is confronted with, but seeing him make the decision that would put his own life in jeopardy to save another. What I tell you, it's, you know, it's like holding a mirror up to yourself, and you discover who you are, and you discover just how pure an act can be, and that's what I saw, and that certainly contributed to my own change. Hmm.
You so powerfully and vividly describe the experience of being in Antarctica, which at one point you describe as one massive sensory deprivation tank. I mean, because so much that is around you is like nothing we ever see or hear or feel.
Right. There's nothing for your senses to sort of seize onto. And you go through your typical day, and there's so many things that you're, you know, from the moment you wake up, your alarm clock, bang, you know, you hear something. You walk down the hall, and maybe your coffee's already brewing, and you smell that. And then you open the morning paper, and the visuals, you know, get you. You turn on your radio, and you hear Greg on the radio, and you know, you're constantly confronted with sounds and sights, colors. But in Antarctica, there's nothing. There's nothing for your senses to grab hold of. It's lifeless, so there's no sound of an animal, of a lawnmower. You know, there's it's odorless, you know, and you're encased in a down suit because it's so cold, you know, 40, 50 below zero, that you can't have any exposed skin. So you have nothing to touch. So there was nothing for the senses to grab a hold of. And the only thing you see is just the white of the ice and the white of the sky. And, you know, at the time that we were climbing, the sun just sort of sat a little bit low in the horizon, never set, and so it's constantly illuminated, and there's no change in the landscape, really. So, it felt like just a big sensory deprivation tank.
Hmm. Coupled with your own experiences in Antarctica, you do such a beautiful job of describing the plight of Robert Falcon Scott and his ill-fated party, who attempted to be the first to reach the South Pole, falling short. Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian, gets there first, and Captain Robert Falcon Scott and all of his men perish in their journey back. And you describe not only crucial errors, heartbreaking errors which he made, but also very movingly describe the sense of connectedness which Captain Scott seemed to feel in the last hours and minutes of his life.
That's, to me, the most compelling part of the story, Greg. So plenty of scholars have looked at Scott's expedition and determined whether he was a sound leader, just experiencing circumstances beyond his control, or whether he was an inept leader. And that's not a debate I wanted to get into, because what I found in the end, what I found so compelling is literally his final moments as he realizes he's not going to make it back. He's going to freeze to death in Antarctica, and he'll never return to England again. He will never see his family again. And it was at that moment he picked up a pen and wrote. And so you get the final words of someone who has confronted his own isolation in the most desperate of circumstances. And what does he do? He expresses his love for his family. And I when I thought about that and realized, look, I don't want to die alone and detached. And so when I was confronting my own isolation in Antarctica, I thought back to that final moment Scott had and realized I don't want to suffer that end. And that also contributed to my reconnection with the world.
If we have time for one more story, I find it interesting that on the heels of that discussion about Antarctica, you turn your attention to your own father, an English professor, and many of the ways in which he raised you and your brothers, and how, in particular, he was a child of the Great Depression, and that guided many of the values he had and priorities as a father. I mean, I really love this part of the book, particularly the story of the glass mustard jar. I mean, in living life in that respect. Can you just say a word about the juxtaposition of these two stories in your book?
So my father, and he had such a challenging time. You know, there are three of us. I was the youngest. I had two older brothers. My mother dies, and he's got to somehow keep all this together. And yeah, I think he went back to what formed him, which was the Great Depression. And I remember moments when we were growing up where he would hold that mustard jar up to the light. He would take his spatula and make sure he got just that last bit of mustard, like it was buffed clean by the time that he was done with it. And that sort of stolid approach that he had, I think, is the steadiness that he had, is what got all of us through our childhood. And I did reflect on that when I was in Antarctica and realized, you know, that there were moments when we just challenged him to the breaking point. But he was steadfast, and he remained solid. And despite the challenges that I had in my own life and the burdens that I put on him, you know, he stood beside me, stood strong.
Well, it's an amazing story. It truly is, that takes us all around the globe and into very, very surprising moments. And of course, no one is more surprised than you at where this journey ultimately takes you, ultimately into marriage, ultimately into Buddhism, ultimately into a life and a view of the world that you never would have thought could be yours. And our listeners can see it all in your book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes, published by Simon & Schuster, including some very interesting photographs, I might add. The author, Francis Slakey. Francis Slakey, thank you so much for telling this powerful and compelling story so well and for joining me on The Morning Show today to talk about it.
Thank you, Greg.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience.